Presenting today, we have K.R. Kent, Vice Chairman and Chief Financial Officer of Ford Motor Credit Company. Mr. Kent has been with Ford Motor Credit Company since 2006, after serving in a variety of previous roles with the Ford organization globally. FMCC's impressive results over the past year have been a significant factor in Ford Co.'s performance. K.R.
Thank you very much. We are webcasting today. I'm going to go through a short presentation. Just hit a few slides of the total presentation, just to kind of set the stage, and then I think we're going to open up to questions. So I will start, for those who do have a presentation on slide four, and just talk about the first 9 months of Ford and Ford Credit. And what you can see here is that total company first 9 months pre-tax operating profits is about $7 billion. And you can see this includes about $4.6 billion in the automotive company and about $2.4 to $2.5 billion for the financial services company. And as you see in the memo at the bottom of the chart, total first 9 months pre-tax operating results improved by $8.6 billion compared with a year ago. I'm going to move to slide six, and this kind of focuses on the One Ford plan. And hopefully you probably have seen this slide before, and it probably looks a little familiar. This is the One Ford plan that Alan Mulally led the development of shortly after arriving at Ford in 2006. And effectively, by focusing on the implementation of the One Ford plan, we have been improving the business and achieving very strong results. The key about the One Ford plan is that the One Ford plan is working. Our efforts are reflected in our strong results through the first 9 months of 2010, which enable continued progress toward repaying our automotive debt. I'll talk a little bit about that. In the third quarter, we actually paid down $2 billion of the drawn amount of the revolving credit line. And at the end of October, we used cash to fully prepay the remaining $3.6 billion of debt we owed the VEBA Retiree Healthcare Trust. And so through the third quarter and including the October paydown in the VEBA debt, Ford Automotive has reduced their debt by $10.8 billion, while liquidity itself has improved slightly. And as we continue to improve the business, we are also focusing on growth in all geographic regions, especially in Asia Pacific. And finally, we are on track to meet our financial targets this year and next year, delivering solid profits in 2010 with positive operating cash flow in the automotive company and continued improvement in 2011. Since I am in the credit company, I'm going to talk a little bit about what we do. And if I move to slide 12, this shows what our strategic priorities are at Ford Credit, and they remain the same. Our primary goal is pretty straightforward, is to support automotive sales. We work at Ford to maximize customer and dealer satisfaction and loyalty, aiming to always provide a full complement of financing products and outstanding service. And we continually fine-tune processes in a structured way to focus on the customer and maintaining process discipline to ensure the efficient use of capital. Move real quickly to slide 15. This shows our third quarter results at Ford Credit. And as you can see, we earned $766 million in the third quarter. Charge-offs for on-balance sheet receivables in the third quarter were $95 million. They're very low at this point in time, and I'll cover a little bit more of that in a second. At the very bottom of the right-hand chart, our managed receivables were about $85 billion at the end of the third quarter, and managed leverage itself was 6.3 to 1 compared to 7.7 to 1 last year at the same time. A little bit on full year 2011, we do expect Ford Credit to be solidly profitable, but at a lower level than 2010, reflecting primarily the non-recurrence of lower lease depreciation expense and non-recurrence of credit loss reserve reductions that we experienced in 2010. It just won't be as high next year. To provide a little bit more detail about 2011, the non-recurrence of lower lease depreciation expense relates primarily to lower gains associated with recovering a portion of the operating lease impairment that we had in 2008, as leases have terminated and the vehicles are sold. We also have fewer lease vehicles terminate in 2011 compared with 2010, resulting in less gains on the vehicles that we are selling. For example, the recovery of lease impairment goes from about $640 million this year to about $240 million next year. And lease terminations decline. This year we had lease terminations of about 400,000, and next year we expect lease terminations of about 230,000. Likewise, we expect the credit loss reserve will begin to level off in 2011. At the end of the third quarter, it was about 1.14% of receivables, and we expect it to level off around 1% next year. give you a little bit of perspective on some of our credit losses. This looks at the Ford Credit U.S. Portfolio. And as you can see, earlier in the decade, Ford Credit, we did make changes to strengthen the originations process so we could better weather an economic downturn. And the results of these changes can be seen in the positive trends in the key metrics since 2004. And while delinquencies, repossession ratio, and severity moved higher during the recent recession, we are seeing good improvements in all credit loss metrics in 2010. This slide also, slide 18, shows the longer-term trends for our on-balance sheet, loss-to-receivable ratios and charge-offs and allowance for credit losses and how we are now returning closer to pre-crisis levels. And both metrics improved earlier last decade, reflecting the changes we made to our originations process at that time. And 2010 has improved from what we experienced during the recent recession. You can see at the top, for the first 9 months, we experienced 47 basis points of losses, which is basically back to where we were in 2006 and 2007. I'm going to move to slide 23. This shows a little bit of our funding strategy. As you can see at the top, we were at $85 billion in managed receivables at the end of the third quarter, and we expect to be about between $80 and $85 billion by the end of the year. Our receivables are primarily funded using term asset-backed securities, term debt, as well as equity, and asset-backed commercial paper. We did end the third quarter with about $20 billion in cash, which includes about $5 billion to support on-balance sheet securitization. Liquidity is obviously very important to us. The top box shows Ford Credit's cash and committed capacity, which includes unsecured credit facilities, FCAR, asset-backed commercial paper lines, and other asset-backed bank capacity. The bottom box shows how we have utilized that to date. And as you can see, as of September 30th, after excluding securitization cash and adjusting for available assets, liquidity was about $42 billion, of which $17.5 billion has been utilized, leaving about $25 billion of liquidity available to us. The $8.2 billion of committed capacity in excess of available assets, which is shown in the top box on the far right, can be used to fund future originations, or we'll work with our bank partners to try to move it around to places where we can utilize it better. Available liquidity is about $4 billion higher than what we had at the end of the second quarter, and is about 29% of managed receivables at this point. And then finally, on a summary basis, the One Ford plan itself is working. Ford had strong results in the first 9 months of 2010, improved the business, and paid down some debt. Ford is focusing on growth, as I mentioned, in all geographic regions, while rallying around trying to get back to investment grade. At Ford Credit, the funding environment has improved dramatically, no surprise, since the beginning of the financial crisis, as demonstrated by our improved access as well as lower spread across all our funding activities. As I showed you earlier, overall delinquencies are down and our dealers are in a much stronger position. We've been very pleased with the recent credit performance being driven by improved auction prices as well as reduced repossessions. And at Ford Credit, we continue to focus on the basics, our strategic priorities to support Ford sales and drive dealer and owner loyalty. And with that, I'll open up to questions.
Great. Thank you so much for the presentation. If I may start out the questioning, can you talk a little bit about the changing regulatory environment, particularly the Dodd-Frank Act, and how that, how you're thinking about compliance and how that changes your business?
Yeah, as far as the Dodd-Frank Act, it's interesting at this point in time because a lot of it is still unknown. The new agency, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, is just starting to get up and running. I think time will tell. There's a lot of rules and that still need to be put in place. One thing that I didn't cover is, you know, we're always compliant. We do the right thing. We focus on the customer. And so if new rules come along, we'll obviously deal with those. But it's kind of too early to tell what will happen. Every once in a while, people will ask about an industrial loan bank. We do have a pending application on an industrial loan bank. It was never going to be a big part of our business. However, under the Dodd-Frank Act, it kind of puts a moratorium on that. One of the agencies is supposed to do a study whether commercial firms should own banks or not in the future. Time will tell on that as well.
And what was the sort of the thought behind the industrial loan bank beyond just sort of cheaper deposit funding? Was there a particular asset class that would be advantageous to fund there?
Good question. The industrial loan bank itself was always going to be a small part of our business. It was a funding diversity approach. I don't know if people are familiar with Rule 23A, but basically what it meant is that the only things that could go into an industrial loan bank retail contracts and lease contracts from dealers that we do not do the wholesale with. So when we have 80% of the wholesale in the U.S., it's not a very large portion of our portfolio that could ever go into an industrial loan bank. But it was diversification of funding was the approach.
Sort of back on the Dodd-Frank question, would you be considered systemic?
I think that's for someone to decide, not me.
Is that something that you're worried about, or
no? It's not something that we're really worried about at this point in time. We do, we run the business well. We never cratered at one point in time. We always have good liquidity. We have great servicing, great originations. We're very confident in our business model, and we're very confident in how we've been running the business.
And what about your use of derivatives?
We do use derivatives. We tend to be primarily interest rate derivatives, a little currency. But the primary focus is that we try to be long funded, so our assets will always mature faster than our debt. At the very back of the presentation, in one of the appendixes, Appendix 9, you can kind of see how our cumulative maturities on the asset side is always quicker than our debt. So we tend to be long funded. As a result of being long funded, you do need to put a few derivatives on in order to match up the interest rate to limit the interest rate exposure. That's one side of the business. The other side, obviously, is on securitization. There are a lot of derivatives that go into a securitization from we call them back-to-back, where the securitization trust is protected, and then we will take the back end of that derivative. It typically happens around, like the good example is on wholesale, for example, or asset-backed commercial paper, probably better. We do an FCAR asset-backed commercial paper program where we issue a commercial paper. The program's about $6.5 billion. It's all short-term paper, zero to or 1 to 270 days, but you're putting behind that asset that are typically retail loans, and then retail loans are a much longer duration, so you need to swap that back. So we do use some derivatives.
Speaking of securitization, do any of the risk retention requirements in Dodd-Frank affect how you might structure those going forward? Obviously, those details aren't out yet.
Details are not out right now. On risk retention, a couple things. At Ford Credit, all our securitizations are on balance sheet. We own all the equity tranches. We never sell off any of the equity tranches. We haven't done a whole loan in, I want to say 2003 maybe. This is several years since we've done a whole loan. So when you consider like a 5% risk retention, if it is the bottom tranche, no problem at all. There's also been talk about doing a vertical slice instead of a horizontal slice. If you get into a vertical slice, then you're starting to cut down on some of the efficiency of our funding. For example, we have to hold 5% of the AAA tranche. We don't think it really makes sense because the real risk is in the bottom tranche, not holding 5% of the AAA.
On your underwriting, you mentioned that one of the reasons for your stellar credit performance through the cycle were origination changes that were made earlier in the decade. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about those?
Yeah, if you go back to 2002-ish or so, we actually had about a $200 billion balance sheet at one point in time. A much larger focus on all brands, all makes, a larger focus on the subprime business, and we kind of decided at one point in time to back off that. For the last 5 years or so, we've had very consistent underwriting. We buy a broad spectrum of business. I don't want to kid anybody. We do buy subprime, but we buy the whole spectrum, and the idea behind what we're doing right now is to originate consistently, and then when we go to do the securitization, that the securitizations all perform consistently. And all you really see coming through our securitization is the overall economy, that some of the recent vintages might perform a little worse than, say, 3 or 4 years ago. We decided to do this approach several years ago. We knew we'd be doing a lot of securitization over time. My treasury guys like to call it a Ford deal is a Ford deal. So when we come to the market on an ABS transaction, on a retail transaction, you know exactly what you're getting. It's the same deal as what you saw last time. It's basically the same portfolio what you saw last time, and you can expect it to probably just perform about the same.
With respect to the non-prime market, what's the availability for non-prime customers right now, and how much do you participate in that segment?
Yeah, as far as non-prime goes, I'll just go to straight subprime. We recognize that based on our underwriting, and FICO is only a piece of our underwriting, we take into consideration the contract characteristics, we take into consideration past history with the client. For example, if you have a low FICO score and you've financed, you know, 2-3 F-150s with us and always made the payments, you work in construction, we're okay with that risk. It's how you underwrite and how you understand what's going on. We recognize about 4-5% of our portfolio is what we would consider to be higher risk. Actual, if you get a 620 and below FICO score, it's a little bit higher than that. We do participate in that market, and we always have and probably always will.
So how have contract characteristics in general changed since the financial crisis? So have they not?
I don't really think they've really changed all that much. No surprise. Typically, there are kind of two types of businesses when we do our underwriting. One is what we call standard rate business, and the other is Sabine business. Sabine business is when the auto company will say, I'll buy down the rate down to a 1.9 or even a 0.0 at one point in time. Typically, when you get down to the low rate side of the business, people like to finance a lot more of the vehicle, and the LTVs are a little bit higher. But then at the same time, you get some of the good credit risk at the same time. Standard rate business is usually a little bit more put down on the vehicle. Yeah, please.
Good morning. What do you think are some of the big drivers of asset performance? I know, auto lenders, other credit lenders talk about employment as being highly correlated. But is there anything else that's highly correlated that you've seen? Number one, obviously, the collateral value also supports some of that. But if you can talk about just what you think are the high correlated or maybe unrecognized drivers of asset performance. And secondly, how much of your portfolio has product protection, so disability insurance or unemployment insurance on the borrower, and how much is that contributing to your asset performance? Thank you.
Yeah, on the second piece, truthfully, I don't know. It's never been a big issue for us, and I really don't have any data as far as that goes. As far as asset performance, there are a couple things that you can think about. One is, and I'll be the first to admit, earlier this year, we expected our profits to be lower in 2010 than we had in 2009. We earned $2 billion pre-tax in 2009, and already through the third quarter, we're at about $2.5 billion. A couple of the key things that have moved on us is with the unemployment rate so high, we did not really truly expect that the credit losses would be as low as they are. It's a bit of a surprise to us, and as a result of the credit losses being low, we had to reduce our reserves and the like. Likewise, the auction market has held up very strong. If you get behind or think about the auto industry and what we do in the financing, we're financing a depreciable asset. It's going down in value every day. I like to say it's not fine wine. They're getting older every day and losing value. And so as a result of that, you kind of know what's going to happen. You kind of can expect it. And so if you have, for example, a repossession, you kind of can have a very good idea of what you're going to get in the price of the vehicle because you're going to end up selling it usually through an auction market in 30, 40 days. Others?
Hi. Three questions for you on floor plan.
Sure.
Now, what percent of the Ford dealers get floor plan financing away from you? Is that mix rising or falling? And lastly, in general, are the non-captive lenders getting more or less competitive on floor plan financing?
Floor plan financing. In the U.S., we do about 80% of the floor plan. And then in Europe, it's 99% or so. One of the key things that we have in our business is that it's not only just the floor plan financing that dealers look at. They look at the entire value proposition. And the way we go to market with the auto company, the way we go to market to the dealers, we do the wholesale, we'll do the retail, we'll do lease, which not everybody participates in the lease product. And then at the same time, we'll buy deeper into the market for them. The subprime that I mentioned earlier. So we'll buy a complete spread of business with the dealers. So I think most dealers look at it as a complete value package. We also do consulting on the side. We have a very good system that we can provide a dealer some basic information about his business compared to other businesses in the region, in the area, in the country. So he can do some benchmarking himself that he can actually look at places he can improve his business. So it's kind of like the whole value package in total of what the dealers are really getting from us. Oh, are the non-captives, non-captives, or the non-captives getting more competitive? We, in the U.S., as I mentioned, we're at 80-81% of the wholesale. Several years ago, we were probably 75-77. Actually, there's been some inflow of dealers coming back to Ford Credit. I think it's a good question, by the way. I mean, time will tell. As banks become stronger, how they start to act in the marketplace.
Please. Could you speak some about the distributions you expect to pay up to Ford, and your leverage expectations, both for the fourth quarter and for next year, please?
Yeah. This year, for 2010, we plan to pay $2.5 billion of dividends to the parent company. We've paid $1.5 billion through the third quarter, so $1 billion in the fourth quarter. We have managed leverage at the end of the third quarter at 6.3-1. Our long-term plan is that we think, based on the riskiness of our assets, that the appropriate leverage should be between 10 and 11 to 1. We're going to start heading back toward 10 to 11 to 1 over time. There's no plan to be real surprises for anybody. For example, in the fourth quarter, we've said that we don't believe our profitability will be as high as what we experienced in recent quarters. So when you pay a $1 billion dividend, the leverage is going to go up a little bit. Usually in the first quarter, in the year-end results in January, we usually announce a couple things for the credit company. One is what we expect the portfolio to be by the end of 2011. Likewise, we'll announce what our expectations on dividends will be. And so we'll cover that in January.
Have the rating agencies opined on, or do you have any view on what the rating agencies might react if your leverage goes back up to 10 or 11 times, or is that not something that...
I can't really speak for the rating agencies. I can give you a little bit of perspective, though. If you go back 2002-ish or so, the riskiness of our portfolio used to be somewhere between 13 and 14 managed leverage. That was kind of the appropriate level. We're now, because of some of the recent volatility in the auction market, for example, the lease product has become a more riskier product, and as a result, the appropriate leverage is probably 10 to 11 to 1. That's why we brought it down. Every year we do what's called a risk-based equity study. We go through the entire portfolio around the world and try to establish, based on our view of the riskiness of those assets, what the appropriate equity we should hold for protection for those. And we did it this year, and it was between 10 and 11 to 1. Now, obviously, if longer term you did more lease, or you backed off lease, or did more wholesale or backed off, you know, it'll move that number around a little bit. But right now we believe 10 to 11 to 1 is about right.
And on the leasing product in general, obviously leasing as a share of your originations has come down since its peak. Some of your competitors, particularly who finance foreign OEMs, have actually increased their leasing share. So what's your view of that product going forward, and do you see your share increasing over time? Do you see the product changing materially?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, there's always a role to play, always a role for lease to play in the overall sales effort. There are people out there that love a 2 or 3 year lease, and at the end of the 3 years, they give the car back and they get a brand new car, and they don't really have to deal with a lot of things. We probably did more leasing going back 4 years ago than we won't get back to those levels is what I'm getting at. We did cut back as it back into 2008. We never left the leasing business. It's always been recognized that it needs to be a part of the business. I don't think it'll get back to the levels that we used to do, but maybe a little higher than what we did in 2008. And right now we work with the auto company and try to figure out what is the appropriate balance.
What about subvention? Do you see incentive spend increasing? I mean, is that a thing of the past? Is that dead? Or obviously it's still material, but it's not anywhere near where it was.
It's a good question. I really can't comment on where I see overall variable marketing going on the auto side or incentives on the auto side. There is a role to play with Savine business. It's where the auto company will buy down the rate and will advertise a 1.9 or a 2.9 or even a 0.0. It is one of the tools in the toolkit for marketing vehicles at this point in time. There's all, you know, you can also put cash on the hood. You can put incentives around features and things like that. Subvention is just always going to be a part of the toolkit.
Can you give us some color on what rate you're originating sort of new prime business at kind of market?
Interest rate?
Yeah.
No, we don't actually disclose that. You can see some of the stuff the Fed publishes.
Sure.
On a monthly basis, you know, we try to be as competitive as we can. We do recognize that we have a little bit of a disadvantage from a cost perspective at this point in time, based on where we are on the credit spectrum, being non-investment grade. But hopefully, over time, that's going to improve as well.
So, I mean, if you look at the Fed data or some of the other survey data out there, you know, sort of prime retail contracts are, for 5 years, are coming in at still north of 5.5%. And even though you're at a funding disadvantage, kind of on a weighted average cost basis, you're still funding significantly less than that. Was that kind of lending spread, and given the quality of the asset class, are you seeing increased competition from maybe commercial banks, or that might drive that spread down? Or?
It is interesting from a couple perspectives. You know, the way we go to market with the auto company, we think we add a lot of value, and sometimes they'll buy down rates. We always compete with the big banks. There are a lot of banks out there that do a lot of auto finance. And one of the things that we go to our dealers and explain is that we do have the entire value proposition, which is different from anyone else in our as a captive. It's a little bit different than just if you had a straight bank. We're there through thick and thin. We were there during the bad times. Even when, you know, the worst it got, the only thing we had ever really done was truly back off a little bit on the lease product. But we never left the lease market. We stayed in the lease market. We stayed in the wholesale. While I mentioned that our wholesale penetration went from mid-70s, 77%, up to over 81%, a lot of it was because dealers were being asked to go someplace else. And we pick up that business. And we'll, you know, as long as it's good business and you're well capitalized, it's good business for us as well.
Can you talk about sort of some of the interesting pricing dynamics in the used vehicle market and kind of where you see that going? Because obviously we've sort of been, I guess you could call it, sort of near record high levels in terms of used vehicle pricing. You know, how long should that persist, do you think?
Yeah, I'm no expert on the used car market, that's for sure. Although it is one of the largest, you know, markets there is out there. I think it's actually a very good barometer on the economy. You know, the aftermarket really tanked off in the first half of 2008 when gas prices really shot through the roof. That was when we took our impairment. And then it came back very, very strong all the way through 2009. About the back half of 2009, September, October, it's been fairly flat, except for normal seasonal adjustments. There's usually a down cycle a little bit in the third quarter. But it's been, you know, with the seasonal factors, it's been very flat for almost a year. You know, up and down a couple percent, but not like we experienced where it would drop 30% and come back 30%. Longer term, over the next couple of years, I think I think of it as the standpoint that it's something that will hold up the prices a little bit. I talk a little bit about that in my presentation, and that is for us, off-lease vehicles are dropping next year because we had backed off in 2008. Other companies had also backed off dramatically and actually didn't do some leasing in 2008, which means that there aren't really, I expect they're not having many vehicles coming back next year. So the supply in kind of a 2 to 3 year category, which is really the place we play for the most part on the auction market, the supply should be down a little bit, which will help hold up prices. Couple that with the fact that, you know, you go back to 2008, the overall industry volumes were down. So there's less vehicles that people will be bringing back in. So I think all those factors should help at least form a floor around auction prices. And that, again, for 12, 18 months, not longer term. Eventually the industry will pick up and everything will get back kind of like to, I'll call it, what it used to be at. But at least for 12, 18 months, it's probably nice. At least in the 2 to 3 year mark, auction market where I play, which is generally where the off-lease vehicles are, as well as repossessions.
Can you talk about your participation in the used vehicle finance market?
Yeah, we do some used vehicles. It is not one of our products that we aggressively pursue. However, with our dealers that we have, the wholesale that we have, there are a lot of dealers that will obviously, a lot of dealers do use vehicles, and we do finance some of the used products.
Is that something that you'd look to expand at some point, or are you happy with your role there?
Longer term, we get a little bit more competitive on our cost. It might be something that we might grow over time, but there are no big efforts to massively go into that market and push it.
Do we have any questions in the audience?
Dealers where you're not providing the floor plan, what's your penetration of new car financing?
Our penetration of new car financing for the dealers that we do not do the floor plan. I don't have a specific number that we disclose at this point in time. It's not effectively zero. Even though we might not do your wholesale, the Savine business that the auto company does, the 1-9 financing, always comes through Ford Credit, no matter who's doing the wholesale. So, for example, we'll still get the same Savine business. Might not get as much standard business, but you definitely get the same Savine business.
You talked about guiding towards a funding mix of 55% to 60% securitized versus unsecured. Kind of what are the factors that are really driving that mix? Obviously, it's changed a lot over the years. And you know, how might a different rate environment change that strategy? And how might if you were to become investment grade, which I think a lot of folks in the market are talking about, how would that affect your secured versus unsecured mix?
Yeah, we moved strongly into the securitization market several years ago, primarily because of it being cheaper funding for us, as opposed to unsecured debt when we're non-investment grade. Over time, longer term, as you move back towards investment grade and investment grade spreads come in, there'll probably be a little bit more in unsecured and less asset-backed securitization, more of a balance than where we are today. Today, right now, it is about cost and what is the best way we can get our cost down.
And does the rate market or the shape of the yield curve have any impact on that strategy?
No, not really. As I mentioned, we really don't take bets on interest rates. We're not 100% term funded or term match funded, but we try to be fairly close to that. One of the reasons why is funding is always lumpy. You do big transactions, whereas we buy retail paper every single day, and because of that, there's always a little bit of a mismatch. But we're not trying to make a bet. So if the interest rates are low, our cost is low. If our interest rates go up, our cost will go up with it. And the idea is try to match up.
Can you talk about how the ABS market has changed just over the past 2 years since the crisis?
As far as how the ABS markets have changed, obviously after the Lehman issue, the ABS markets for the most part shut down. And then only when TALF came along and started to jumpstart the market again. I would say that it is almost back to where it was before the crisis. I do believe a big chunk of it is when people started getting worried about CDOs and mortgages, and they just decided that I'm just really uncomfortable in the asset-backed market. I'm not quite sure what I own. And what's really happened is over the last couple of years that auto ABS, for the most part, I'll talk to our auto ABS, but for the most part, has come through with flying colors. There were no transactions that went belly up. They always perform. They always pay down. And I think because of that, people are being able to discern a little bit about what they have been buying. And our ABS market has really come back strong. Now, I'll give you an example of that, is that not only retail ABS is almost back to where the spreads, almost back to where they were pre-crisis. Wholesale and lease is a little bit higher still. But a very encouraging sign for us has been that Canada has come back. And on the ABS side, we've been getting a lot of the ABS transactions done in Canada. And even on the unsecured side, we did a $500 million deal a few months ago in Canada. And for the size of Canada, that's a very large deal. I think people are getting more comfortable about what they're buying and are starting to discern a little bit about different companies.
Is there another question? Is there a difference between, obviously the retail ABS market is quite strong, but have the floor plan and lease markets come back as strongly? Or there?
Yeah, floor plan and lease, we're having no problems doing securitization at this point in time. We've done several transactions this year, a lot in the private market, but some in the public market. And as I mentioned, one of the key ways to look at the business is not only do you have access, but then what are the spreads on that? And as I mentioned, retail is almost back to where it was pre-crisis. Wholesale and lease are still a little bit elevated, but compared to where it started off in, say, March, April of 2009, they're dramatically improved. So it turned out to be very good funding for us at this point in time.
You talked about the Canadian dollar deal that you've done. Mm-hmm. How do you think about opportunities outside of the U.S. dollar funding market?
We do have obviously have a larger operation in Canada. We do have a bank in the U.K. that does our European operation, FCE Bank. And if you're interested in FCE Bank, they do issue both ABS and unsecured on their own. And they're out on the website, and you can take a look at FCE Bank. But as far as I'm concerned, the European market has come back pretty strong. It's never been as deep and liquid as the U.S. market, but we're doing really good in the European market. We actually did, for example, an unsecured deal 2 weeks ago in the U.K. For £400 million, which was a pretty good deal for us because the U.K. market is a little bit different than the rest of the European continent. Get a transaction done, we were very pleased.
You talked about the high cash balances that you're holding on your balance sheet right now. Mm-hmm. What do you think your excess cash position is, and sort of how do you see that changing over time, deploying that over time? Obviously, you've been buying back in the open market.
Yeah, as far as I'm concerned, we've held back equity to make sure we can fund the business. We've maintained a substantial liquidity position. And I think going far into the future, eventually you'd think it'd come down a little bit. But I don't want to give too much information. But we're trying to do a whole balance of the whole business. We'll always have a good liquidity in the credit company. In the end, when you really think about it, we're here to support forward sales. If that means I have to hold a little bit of extra equity or a little bit extra liquidity, we'll do that because the whole idea is that we continue to help forward.
And just one last question, kind of on FCE Bank, as you mentioned. How do you think about, obviously, it's a regulated institution, how do you think about capital and liquidity requirements there? And I've noticed that you've taken some large distributions from that institution over the past year. What are your goals and strategy relating to that?
Yeah, FCE Bank, as I mentioned, is a regulated bank by the FSA, so we follow all the Basel and liquidity requirements and everything else like that. We do have a substantial equity in FCE Bank. I think a Tier 1, 22% is probably one of the highest capitalized companies, banks in Europe. We did pay a dividend in 2010. We'll probably, we'll pay dividends in the future as well. But again, everything that we do is to run a conservative operation. And so that's not going to change over time.
Great.
Okay.
Are there any other questions from the audience? Well, thank you very much, Kara.
Thank you very much.